Hello, and welcome to Pop DNA, the podcast that explores the historical and literary influences on your favorite works of pop culture.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rhonda. So I don't think that we have ever said, but we do have an email address for the podcast as well as a Facebook page. And those are two ways that you can contact us. If you ever have comments or questions or suggestions, or if you want to partner with us in some way, so you can reach us at popdnapodcast@gmail.com. And on Facebook, just search for Pop DNA Podcast, should be the first result. But there's also a link to the Facebook page on the contact section of our blog, which again is thepopdna.blog. Because, you know, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what you think and
absolutely
what you want to hear about. I mean, we usually just talk about whatever we want to talk about, but
it's true.
You know, if you know, listener feedback might be fun. So yeah, so we want to hear from you.
As Carole King would say, thank you for being a friend. That wasn't Carole King.
Nope, I just the Golden Girls.
Oh well.
Thank you for being
that one. So if you're down on the road though, Gilmore Girls. Oh. Carole King is what I was thinking of.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I don't even know who does sing the Golden Girls song. Travel down the road and back again.
That could be your first email to us, is letting
us
know.
Please let us know we don't who know. Sings the Golden Girls theme song.
We can't just Google it. You have to tell us.
We can't. Yes, please email us and tell us.
So now that I've ruined the episode, today we are talking about the TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yay!
So Buffy the Vampire Slayer initially aired on the WB for 5 seasons between 1997 and 2001 before moving to UPN for seasons 6 and 7 from 2001 to 2003.
Yeah. And then its creator... That was a great year.
It was very talking it out on the Very Good Talk Show.
Talking it out
on the Very Good Talk Show.
Oh my gosh, we're so distracted right now. Okay, its creator and executive producer, Joss Whedon, who we have feelings about that we'll get into later, has continued Buffy's adventures in comic book form. Yeah. And the comic books are still being written and published as recently as last year.
So cool.
Like continued, but I haven't read them, so I don't know.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I don't know what's going on in Buffy's life right now, but I know that she's still out there somewhere slaying.
Yeah.
Slaying away like Beyonce.
Gotta check up on her. Yeah.
Should we even bother with a spoiler warning?
If you haven't seen it by now, pause the episode. Go watch it. It's really fun.
Yeah, watch all 7 seasons.
And then come back. But
come back. It's all on Hulu, by the way.
Yeah, go watch it.
And it's on right now, actually, as we're recording this.
Yeah.
Tara and Willow are very serious. Okay. I don't know if this is a good idea.
It's a great episode.
All right. Erin, tell me about your childhood experiences with Buffy.
I was waiting for you to specify with Buffy. I was like, well, there was a time I was 4.
Just all of them. Tell me your life story.
So, I think, similarly with a lot of people our age, Buffy was always just on television. Like,
sure.
I would come home from class, high school or middle school, and it would just be on, like, you know, UPN or whatever,
on,
WB.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, in syndication, it was on, like, FX or USA or something like that.
It was always on. I do remember, however, though, that Buffy was very helpful to me and my group of friends as we kind of navigated, like, sexual preference. I think Willow was a big deal for a lot of people that were very close to me as they figured their preferences out. So I think that's my first real interaction with Buffy, was talking about those kind of delicate subjects of finding yourself.
Yeah, that's something that's tough to navigate already. Yeah,
absolutely.
And then, yeah.
So it was nice to have a campy, like, show like Buffy where we could also think about these bigger topics. So I always think of that when I think of Buffy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty deep.
Yeah. I'm not usually deep on this show, so I figured I'd try it out. What about you, Rhonda?
I think I told you earlier, the very first episode, I actually have a very clear, distinct memory of the first time I watched Buffy because it was at school. Yeah. So it was, so I do remember like being aware of it, mm-hmm. like when it was on, but you know, it was like what it started in 97.
Yes.
So I was like 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like aware that it was on, but I think I maybe just assumed that my parents wouldn't let me watch it. So I was just like, oh, this is something that I'm never going to see. Okay.
Sure. Totally. Yeah.
And then, like, by the time I was old enough, it was, like, it was too late. Like, it's already into it. It's kind of like trying to start watching Game of Thrones right now.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah.
It's already the last season. It's too late to catch up. So just don't even bother. That was kind of how I felt about Buffy.
Yeah.
When I was, like, a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, I get that.
But my sophomore English teacher was, like, one of my favorite teachers ever, and she was a huge Buffy fan.
Yeah.
And we happened to be reading, well, I'm sure she planned it this way. We were reading Frankenstein in class.
Oh.
So she showed us the episode of Buffy.
That's amazing.
That's basically like Frankenstein.
That's so good.
It's like the two guys who are like killing all the girls and like putting their parts together.
Oh.
Like, so it's like Weird Science, but like creepier.
Oh,
like,
goodness.
If Weird Science can get creepier.
Uh-huh.
But it already is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was that episode. So that's the first one I ever saw. And I was like, this is not. 15-year-old me is like, this is not what I thought it was. And then I like kind of forgot about it again.
Yeah.
And then I actually ended up borrowing, a friend of mine had like all the seasons on DVD when I was like in college, so I was like 19, 20.
Yeah,
so I was like borrowing all of her DVDs, and that was how I ended up watching the entire series. So.
Yeah,
and that was fun.
It's a fun one.
It's a good one to binge.
Oh my gosh, yeah,
and that was around like I think around the time when shows started releasing entire seasons on DVD, that was like one of the first ones that was really, and of course they all have like commentaries.
Yes.
On the episodes, so
I remember we used to do that with The Simpsons, okay. But you could only get one disc. So we'd be like, okay, but
was
this
it through Netflix? Or
it was
like,
through our like or small Ojai Video shout out that's no longer there. But me and my best friend Dylan would be like, okay, but this disc has this episode, but that disc has that episode, and we could only pick one. So, yeah.
You could only pick one.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like one episode per disc?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Ojai Video was like the strict parent you never knew you wanted.
The Simpsons is only like 20 minutes long.
Yeah, they were just
stingy. Could have put more.
Mm-hmm. And you only had from like the day before until the next day at 6 p.m. to watch your Ojai Video.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry you had to go through that as a child.
I really recovered, you know.
Okay, wait, what were we talking about?
Buffy.
Okay. All right, so... So it's really interesting. So when I first, you know, like a year and a half ago, first got the idea to do this podcast, the first thing I wanted to talk about was Wonder Woman, which we did. But the second thing that I thought of that would be so great to talk about in this context was Buffy. And it's, you know, because I think that like there's like, you can take classes at some colleges in, like, Buffy studies.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, like, rich and, like, full of things to dissect. And, you know, the premise of the podcast relies on the assumption that works of pop culture, like movies and TV shows, deserve to be studied on that level.
Yeah.
And, you know, deserve to have that same degree of academic depth and research as works of classic literature, which, you know, I was a literature major, so like that was what I did. And I just wanted to do that about, you know, things that I like watching on TV. And, you know, Buffy is, like I mentioned, Buffy is a work that has had this kind of study and interpretation and analysis around it more than a lot of other shows. Although there are some other shows that kind of have that same level of discussion, like Mad Men, Breaking Bad, The Sopranos, Game of Thrones. But I think, well, Buffy definitely predates all of those other shows.
Absolutely.
It was around earlier, and also the kind of study of Buffy, like Buffy was kind of the first show that people were like, oh, we can actually study this. Like, it's a work of literature. and so Buffy was before all of those. And it also sets itself apart from those other shows like Mad Men, Game of Thrones, Sopranos, etc. It's the only one of those that has a teenage girl as the hero.
Yeah.
Or really any, you know, female as the hero.
Right.
And that's also probably, I mean, definitely why it's not viewed with the same level of prestige as most of those other shows.
Yeah.
I mean, you can talk about like Buffy's production quality, which is a little bit lower, but you know, it was on like the like most obscure basic, you know, network channel. Absolutely. Like they didn't have the budget. Yeah. But it's also just a cultural phenomenon that works that are created about and for teenage girls and young women are often looked down upon. And they're seen as, you know, more trivial, lower quality, just because of their intended audience.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thought is teenage girls like it. Well, it must be frivolous and, you know, because teenage girls and young women are frivolous and vapid and.
Yeah, right? Of course.
Yeah. That's, that's totally.
Totally true.
Okay, yeah, that's,
That's
not how we feel,
you guys.
We're totally being sarcastic.
I thought you knew us better than that, you guys. tough crowd today.
Yeah. I mean, is this thing on? but I just, so we kind of already alluded to this. At some point, we're going to have to talk about Joss Whedon, but to his credit, this is a story that nobody else was telling at that time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, he put forward this teenage girl who is a strong, you know, fully realized person.
Yeah, totally.
And she's leading this group of people who's saving the world. And that had never really, we hadn't really seen that before.
Yeah.
So that's what he did with that show. But there was an earlier Buffy.
Oh.
That I'm sure most Buffy fans already know there was a Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie in 1992, so 5 years before the show started. And, you know, a lot of people believe that if the movie had actually turned out the way that Joss Whedon intended, we might not have gotten the TV series at all.
Sure.
The final product of the movie did not fit with Whedon's vision at all. In fact, it's even, like, there's kind of, like, this lore around it that he actually, like, walked off the set of the movie because it was just not going the way that he wanted it to at all.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to watch the movie and to compare this origin story with what the show eventually became.
Right. Sure.
Because the movie is much less dark, I think, than, you know, the show goes to some pretty dark places.
Yeah.
The movie didn't really have that. And that's the way that Joss Whedon originally wanted it. He wanted that kind of darkness and to be in there.
Sure.
But we just discovered there's an even earlier incarnation of this character.
Plot twist.
And it was, what was it called again?
It was called Rhonda the Immortal Waitress.
What?
Oh my goodness.
Why didn't he want to stick with that name?
I think that that's pretty That's a bad choice on his part. He should have stuck with Rhonda. Come on. Come on.
I wonder if she was a medieval gentlewoman.
Oh, I hope. I mean, it would only be truthful if she was.
But that that early script apparently eventually became the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's got an interesting story there. Yeah. So it's, I kind of wonder how vampires got into that story. Because she's she's Rhonda the Immortal Waitress. So is she a vampire and that's how she's immortal?
I hope a lot of garlic bread.
Ooh.
Oh.
But Jim, this garlic bread is cold. Oh, Joss Whedon directed that episode of The Office.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was not happy about that.
No.
But yeah, I wonder how vampires got into that.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, I guess we'll never know. But the notion of vampirism has existed for thousands of years.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah. I'm sure Joss Whedon knew that. And he was like, you know, we're going to get this 1,000-year-old tradition into this movie. We're doing so great today. So just a little bit of history about, you know, vampire legends, because that's a smooth transition. cultures all over the world have had vampire-like creatures in their mythology. Mesopotamia and the ancient Hebrews. The Greeks and Romans had tales of like spirits or demons that are considered kind of the precursors of modern vampires.
Okay.
They weren't exactly like what we would recognize as a vampire today.
Yeah.
But what we would recognize today, it's almost exclusively from like early 1700s in southeastern Europe.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's when the verbal traditions of a lot of groups in that area of that region were starting to be written down.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, that's around, well, it's a little bit after the time that of the printing press, but it's when, you know, published books were being, you know, becoming more and more common. So they were writing down these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then they eventually made their way, you know, west to like Germany and England. But in these stories, so like in these early legends, vampires are usually revenants.
Okay.
Which a revenant is not just Leonardo DiCaprio, in case you're in case you're wondering.
But I love him.
Where he fights a bear, right? Or no, like the bear like mauls him. It's been a long time since I saw it. but a revenant is actually it's a ghost. Or an animated corpse, or it's just like kind of some remnant of a person who has died.
Yeah.
So like the corpse that's been revived and comes back to haunt the living.
Okay.
So vampires were considered revenants of evil beings, sometimes of suicide victims.
Oh, wow.
Or of witches.
Okay.
So vampires were tied to witches in this folklore. That they believed that when a witch died, they could become a vampire.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
But they could also be created by a spirit possessing a corpse or by a living person being bitten by a vampire. Which
gotcha.
Is the one that has survived to now.
Yeah.
So these beliefs in these creatures became so widespread that there was kind of like, much like there was that kind of mass hysteria around witch hunting in Europe.
Yeah.
In like the 16th, 17th, 18th, a little bit in the 18th centuries, it was very similar to that, with people that they believed could be vampires.
Yeah.
They had, you know, public executions just like they did with the, you know, believed witches.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very, one of the earliest recordings of supposed vampire activity comes from what today is Croatia in 1672. So yeah, it's that southeastern Europe mm-hmm. is where we get that legend. So 1672, there was a peasant who had died in 1656. And then people in the village claimed that they saw him return from the dead and begin to drink blood from people. Yeah. So like not the most, I mean, these are not pleasant stories,
no.
but the village leader ordered that a stake be driven through his heart. But then it, like, that didn't work. It didn't kill him.
Okay.
So then he was beheaded.
Wow.
And that one stuck. That worked. Yeah. So that's, I think like either the earliest or at least one of the earliest recorded accounts of a vampire sighting was that 1672.
Fascinating.
Sighting. So there are some different like kind of psychosocial explanations for why these vampire legends exist.
Yeah.
So we have in this book by Paul Barber, Vampires, Burial, and Death. So he describes the belief in vampires as resulting from people, you know, in pre-industrial society, people would try to explain natural phenomena, but, you know, it was like natural explanations, but it was kind of inexplicable because they couldn't really see the process that was happening.
Yeah.
So they would try to explain, you know, kind of this process of death and decomposition.
Sure.
From what they observed.
Sure.
But couldn't really figure out how to explain it.
Yeah.
So people suspected that vampires occurred when, or, you know, that someone was a vampire when, like, the corpse or the cadaver didn't look the way that they thought a normal corpse should look.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, decomposition, like, it varies vastly, mm-hmm. you know, depending on like the conditions that the person is buried in, the soil composition, the temperature, the climate. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the signs aren't really widely known, or they weren't back then.
Yeah.
So this would lead to like, there were people who were actually like vampire hunters, like they called themselves vampire hunters. And they would conclude that a dead body hadn't decomposed or as, mm-hmm. you know, like as much as it should have. And, you know, they would assume that that meant that they, you know, that that body was still living somehow.
Sure.
So like, oh, well, he still like has all those teeth, must be a vampire.
That's nice. 'Cause you can't really disprove that. You can't
Yeah. Like you can't, well, and it's convenient that vampires only walk around at nighttime.
Sure.
So, of course, he's still in his coffin. It's daytime. Mm-hmm. You know, he's sleeping.
Oh, fascinating.
Vampires sleep during the day.
Yeah.
yeah. So, some really interesting ideas of how this legend came to be. Because there were people who, you know, believed that, like, vampires were real things. Like, they didn't, they didn't start out as just, you know, a fictional invention.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, people really believed this.
Yeah.
And then as we get into, you know, the late 18th century and the early 19th century, we start to see vampires show up in the literature of, especially, well, of course, we speak the English language, so we know about the literature of England.
Yeah.
I have a degree in that. The literature of England. the very, like, the first, like, really popular story about a vampire was called The Vampire, but with a Y. So it's VAMPYRE.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah. So, and this is written by John Polidori. And it featured a vampire named Lord Ruthven.
Oh.
So it's about a young, wealthy Englishman named Aubrey. And he meets this suave nobleman, Lord Ruthven, who's actually a vampire, but Aubrey doesn't know that.
Shoot.
Yeah. And so they just like go travel around Europe together for a while. Before Aubrey kind of starts to notice that some like strange shenanigans are happening around his new friend. So like at one point Aubrey falls in love with this girl in Greece.
Yeah.
But then she like mysteriously dies.
Oh.
And but he like doesn't connect it. Like he doesn't realize that it's, you know,
yeah,
this vampire dude killed her. We spoiler. If you haven't read the story. But I mean, was there any doubt? Okay, so, but of course, like us, like in our culture now, we read this and we're like, well, duh.
Right.
But back then,
of course,
you like, it was like, you know, yeah, it was groundbreaking, no pun intended. So eventually what happens is that, Lord Ruthven is apparently mortally wounded
mm-hmm.
by bandits, and then he quote-unquote dies.
Yeah.
And Aubrey goes back to England. But then his friend shows back up, and he's like, what? So he knows that this dude is trouble.
Shoot.
But he's not, like, he kind of has, like a nervous breakdown about, like, oh, like,
yeah,
this is, I mean, it's probably,
sure,
like, pretty traumatic.
Yeah.
So he knows this guy's no good. He's like, bad news. But then the vampire gets engaged to Aubrey's sister. And Aubrey's like, not if I can help it. And but he's like really sick now, and he's
he's
dying. So he writes a letter to his sister to warn her, but she doesn't read it in time.
No.
And then Aubrey dies because of, you know, like, it was just too much for him.
Yeah.
So the vampire marries Aubrey's sister, and then the next morning she is found dead, drained of blood.
No!
And Lord Ruthven has disappeared.
Oh, no!
And that's the end of the story.
Oh, man!
Super fun, guys.
Yeah.
All right. So, and that was in 1819. So,
oh,
you know, that's around the same time as, like, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is, like, very, you know, this is very popular literature,
yeah,
at the time. The next notable work that we have is Carmilla from 1872. By Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu. So this was first published as a serial, as a lot of things were.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is narrated by a young woman who is, like being preyed upon by a female vampire named Carmilla. And this is really an interesting one because I think this was probably the first really popular example of a female vampire.
Yeah, sure.
And she's later revealed to be this, like, countess,
ooh,
lady. And the character is a prototypical example of the lesbian vampire.
Interesting.
She expresses romantic desires toward the protagonist.
Oh.
And is depicted as, that desire that she expresses is depicted, you know, as like a trait of being a villain.
Of course. Sure.
Because of that time.
Sure.
Just because of their, you know, the views that, you know,
yeah,
were standard at that time.
Yeah.
So we actually can see echoes of Carmilla, particularly in the Buffy episode Doppelgangland in,
yeah,
season 3. In which in an earlier episode,
yeah,
we see there's an alternate reality where Buffy never came to Sunnydale. And in that reality, Willow's a vampire.
Mm-hmm,
So in this episode, Doppelgangland, vampire Willow from that alternate reality is brought into the main reality through a spell. And so vampire Willow meets real Willow or human Willow. Uh-huh. And she shows some pretty clear attraction toward her.
Yeah.
And then a little later when, like, so I don't remember exactly how it happens, but, like, they subdue vampire Willow and human Willow is, like, explaining what's going on. And she says, I think I'm kind of gay.
Aww, I love that. That's cute.
And then, what's interesting is, like, Buffy's, like, comforting her and she's telling her, like, a vampire's personality doesn't really have anything to do with the person, you know, the human person that they were before. And it's funny because Angel's standing there and he's like, well, actually, and then he's like, oh, never mind.
Uh-huh.
So that was really funny.
I like this show a lot.
Uh-huh. It's like he decided not to mansplain.
Aw, thanks, Angel. Could you have told Joss Whedon, maybe? Maybe. I promise that's my last dig at him, I promise.
Oh, no, it's not.
It's not. That was a lie. That was a lie, listeners. Sorry.
Joss Whedon. Okay, so... If you're like hanging on in anticipation, like when's she gonna talk about Dracula? It's right now.
Ew.
So, so vampire fiction fell under this kind of larger umbrella of Victorian popular fiction known as penny dreadfuls.
Yeah.
And then of course we culminate in that like ultimate vampire novel in 1897. Bram Stoker's Dracula. So this novel introduces the character of Count Dracula.
Uh-huh.
Who is also in an episode of Buffy.
Oh.
BT Dubs.
Look at him.
and this Dracula really established most of the common conventions of vampire fiction that we still kind of think of as like canon, quote unquote, vampire canon today.
Sure.
So most of the traits that we associate with vampires, like fangs,
okay,
aversion to like crosses and garlic and holy water,
uh-huh,
all of those things came from Dracula. So like even if you've never read a vampire story or seen a vampire movie or show, I don't know why you're listening to this if you haven't, but you probably know some things about vampires that came from that kind of unofficial canon of vampire fiction defined by Dracula just through like cultural osmosis.
Yeah.
Like these things are just kind of out there in the nebulous pop culture, like cloud of things. So the novel Dracula tells the story of Count Dracula, who's actually Vlad the Impaler, or Vlad Dracul, which means the dragon, by the way. Yeah, I kind of know things about that. So
I like it.
So he is attempting to move from Transylvania to not another Sylvania, like Pennsylvania.
Just white.
but he's moving to England, because apparently, like, the humans in England have better blood than other places.
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
Stoker was Irish. Yeah. So I don't know, like, what.
Yeah, he was.
Like, he's like, yeah, you should go to England.
Go to England and don't kill the
And then
Irish.
He's trying to, like, spread his undead curse. Because I don't know, like, he wants some vampire friends, maybe.
Okay.
and then the battle that ends up happening between Dracula and a small group of like ragtag band of misfits led by Abraham Van Helsing.
Of course.
Van Helsing, yeah. So Van Helsing is a vampire expert. He's really more of like a scholar, scientist, philosopher in the novel.
Okay.
He's not really like that action hero vampire hunter that we see in a lot of film adaptations or of a movie Van Helsing starring Hugh Jackman.
Yikes.
Which they just talked about on How Did This Get
Made. Yeah, watch that episode. That's amazing.
How Did This Get Made?
Anyone who doesn't listen to How Did This Get Made is...
How Did This Get Made?
You gotta watch it.
We actually get $50 every time we say, How Did This Get Made? So
I say it all day.
So, but I have to imagine that this perception of Van Helsing as this like action hero vampire hunter is maybe a little bit influential on the idea of a vampire slayer.
Yeah, maybe? Sure.
One ring to rule them all. Oh, that's something else.
That's our notes for something else.
Yeah, we're talking about that next month. Oh, here we are. Okay.
We really are,
you guys.
Yeah.
So Van Helsing carries the following in his arsenal. And tell me if this sounds familiar.
Okay. I will.
All right. A wreath of withered garlic blossoms.
Okay.
A silver crucifix.
Okay.
Sacred water.
Uh-huh.
Electric lamps, which can be attached or secured against the chest.
Okay.
We don't say that as much, but sure. That's clever.
That is clever.
It's like vampires don't know about electricity. They uh-huh. think, oh, he has the sun.
Gotta go. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Okay. A revolver and knife for use against enemies weaker than Dracula.
Okay.
This one's interesting. I haven't heard this anywhere else. The branch of a wild rose could be placed on top of a coffin containing a vampire and would immobilize it.
Oh,
I've not heard that before.
I haven't either.
That would be super useful if you were a vampire hunter.
Shoot. I gotta go get a rose.
Mountain ash used to repel the undead.
Okay.
A wooden stake and hammer to pierce mm-hmm. a vampire's heart. So in Dracula, you have to actually like hammer the stake into the vampire's chest. So you have to, like, get the vampire to stay still long enough for
you
to hammer
it in. Can you just hold on?
Hold on, I'm, like, hammering the
stake really hard. It's just...
Because, like, on Buffy, she just, like, basically just, like, pokes them and they turn into dust.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, super convenient cleanup.
Really?
You don't have a body to take care of.
I know, you just need a broom.
And then he has a golden crucifix necklace that he gives to Lucy, who's one of the characters in the book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of fun, I think. Yeah. Like, when I first read Dracula, I didn't like it. But I hadn't seen Buffy yet the first time I read Dracula. So, that's probably why.
Yeah.
And I also hadn't seen Van Helsing yet.
Sure. And I think it can be... At the beginning, it can be a drier read.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like, it's, you know, the epistolary novel was so hot back then. And that's kind of how it is.
Uh-huh.
But, like, people, you know, because that was what people did. They wrote letters, and so.
Sure.
They're, you know, yeah. It was, I'm going to take a sip now.
As I've gotten older, I've wanted to reread it, because I tried to read it when I was younger, and I was just... I was
not
bored. The beginning bored me. Sorry.
Yeah.
But now that I'm an adult, I feel like I should try it again.
Well, I'll just move on here to vampires and history.
Yeah.
So we heard a little bit about the history of vampires.
Uh-huh.
But one thing that's really interesting about having vampires as characters in your story, you know, since vampires like live a long time, they can remember some really interesting periods of history.
Sure.
So on Buffy, we get to see those historical periods in flashbacks. We do also see like some other creatures besides vampires who've been around for a few centuries. So like Anya, she was like a villager in like 9th century Sweden or something. Before she became a chaos demon. So I have in here just a note about like the Inca mummy girl from 15th century Peru. So like it's been a long time since I saw that episode, so I don't remember exactly what her nefarious plan was. But it involved seducing Xander for some reason. And then Anya also. They all like go after Xander.
They're all like for Xander. Oh, dear.
Yeah, that's interesting. But the season 5 episode, Fool for Love, which is the one that I was watching when you came over.
Yeah, which has a bizarre homage to the Sam Shepard play of the same name, which is about incest. Super weird.
Whoa.
Anyway, yeah. Super weird.
Like Game of Thrones.
Do 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 do. Sorry.
You know nothing. So Fool for Love in season 5, I think it's regarded by Buffy experts as like one of the better episodes of, I mean, how can you choose?
I know.
But like, I think I like it.
Yeah.
A lot because it has a lot of historical flashbacks.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of a history nerd.
Yeah.
So the really weird one that I want to talk about is Spike's recounting of his killing of a slayer in China in 1900 during the Boxer Rebellion.
Huh.
Why is it? Okay. So I had to know about the Boxer Rebellion because they're so specific. They say it like several times and oh yeah, it's during the Boxer Rebellion. Like everybody knows what that is. I didn't know what that was.
Right.
So we had to read about it. So this is directly from the History Channel website.
Fancy.
History Channel. That's what I watched in high school instead of Buffy.
Yeah.
So this is their explanation of what the Boxer Rebellion was. So the Chinese secret organization called the Society of the Righteous and Harmonious Fists led an uprising in northern China against the spread of Western and Japanese influence. The rebels, referred to by Westerners as boxers, because they performed physical exercises they believed would make them able to withstand bullets, killed foreigners and Chinese Christians, and destroyed foreign property. From June to August, the boxers besieged the foreign district of Beijing, then called Peking, China's capital, until an international force that included American troops subdued the uprising. Excuse me. By the terms,
I just thought you were getting emotional.
By the terms of the Boxer Protocol, which officially ended the rebellion in 1901, China agreed to pay more than $330 million in reparations.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was like, China's like the parent whose child is like being unruly and and like throwing rocks at someone at the neighbor's window.
Right.
And China's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'll pay for your window. I'm sorry my child did that to you. That's basically what it was. But you know, I think I read that the US actually forgave the, like, they were like, yeah, you don't have to pay us for that. Like, it wasn't your fault.
Okay.
I think several other countries did that, too.
I hope so.
Like,
yeah.
Countries who helped them.
Like, yes.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting, it's an interesting moment in history. Because, like, I kind of, like, see both sides of it. So you have, like, this group, you know, kind of like this grassroots movement that sees that their country is kind of is being taken advantage
of course.
By, you know, these foreign, you know, Western cultures that are coming in and, you know, kind of taking advantage of China and their resources. So I see that side of it, but also like, I mean, sometimes violence is necessary to, you know, overthrow, you know, oppressive regimes.
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just a really, why do they make this reference in Buffy? I feel like it means something, but I don't know what.
It's a very bizarre.
It's a very specific reference and also, so in the flashback, we see that not only Spike, but also Drusilla and Angel and Darla are all in China in 1900 during the Boxer Rebellion.
Huh.
Why?
Why?
I mean, they've been traveling around Europe together for like, and like Angel's cursed by the gypsy and stuff. Uh-huh, and like, or, well, we don't have to use that word.
Sure.
But, you know,
sure.
But so they've been like traveling around Europe for like centuries. And then, or decades at least.
Yeah.
Decades.
A lot of time.
And then they like just randomly go to China because they're like, hey, I heard the boxers are rebelling.
Oh,
let's go to China. I don't know.
That's
so
bizarre.
I don't really have an explanation for why they're there or why I am so curious about it.
Yeah. Because it's a very like,
I don't,
It's just such an obscure.
It is kind of obscure. Maybe it's really not that obscure, sure. And I am just uninformed.
Sure. That's how always possible. What you just said about the terms like gypsy and things are one critique that I have of Buffy.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Is that it's kind of littered with language we wouldn't use today. So that's something that I was thinking a lot about, and I didn't write anything about that, but when you just mentioned that, I was like, oh yeah. Like,
yeah, that's
a word that you use right now that maybe we shouldn't have, Joss Whedon. I know I always talk about this, but it's also definitely true of different, just so many communities of people, like maybe individuals who experience a disability get some negative treatment on this show, as well as there's a lot of body shaming as well, which is, which leads me to Cordelia in season one, at least. So I'm kind of fascinated with Cordelia, and I kind of started with a quote from her that we're in. It's the pilot of the episode, and we're really getting to know her, and she says, "I'm just not one to settle. It's like when I go shopping. I have to have the most expensive thing. Not because it's expensive, but because it costs more." Which I actually really appreciated the writing of that, because it felt like a mocking critique of this kind of romanticized elitist high school culture where status is everything. Basically everything we talked about in the Mean Girls episode is being made fun of with characters like Cordelia. And I did think that was a nice breath of fresh air there for everything I've said against Joss Whedon. That was kind of a nice moment where, like, we're making fun of this. And Cordelia is just so much a part of that consumer teen culture in these first episodes. I focused my study, since I watched so much of this show growing up, I really wanted to focus on the beginnings and the very stylized super 90s episodes in the very beginning, because they're kind of fun. Right.
The music.
The 30-year-olds playing teens, although I guess David Boreanaz is 28, but
I mean, that's still, like, what happens today. Like, you still have, like, well, maybe, like, early 20s playing 16.
Yeah.
Is still, like, standard.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, as I mentioned before, I'll always have concerns with shows, like this in regards to the body shaming that happens right off the bat in the first episode of season one. We're getting jokes about people who are overweight. It's just, no thank you. We don't need to do that anymore. So just wanted to have a note about that. And then I think also a jumping off point for talking about Willow as a nonconformist is to talk about Cordelia, because Cordelia
she is a conformist.
Yeah. And she tries to kind of force Willow into a box. But I really, really love how Willow is presented in the pilot of Buffy and how her character is set up. So the pilot does an excellent job at placing us in the world of high school, again, as we talked about in Mean Girls. Where everyone's opinion of you is the most important thing, and you kind of don't have a say in whether you're a good person or whether you're cool or whether you're interesting unless other people like you. And so in this world of Cordelia's attempting to eviscerate the Willows, we see this Willow a little quirky, a little maybe quiet, but definitely, I would argue, confident in herself. I think she's momentarily affected by Cordelia's words, as we all are when someone's randomly, like, mean to us on the way to the lunch table.
Like, who asked you?
Like, why are you here right now? No, in your lime pants, by the way.
Oh,
lime.
There were a lot of leather pants on this show.
Oh, gosh, leather.
That maybe should not have ever existed.
Corduroy, unless you're.
And interesting hats, too.
Ooh, the
like,
hats.
A lot of bucket hats on Willow.
Buddy. So whenever we see Willow kind of get teased or get bullied, she has a moment of reaction, but then she moves on with her life and her interests. And I think Allison Hannigan gives such a truthful performance.
I love her.
Oh, she's delightful. She's very much a student who is excited about the world and who knows that she's strong and intelligent and yet is also struggling with that fitting in piece. I think I really appreciated seeing her be so true to herself and ultimately decide that conforming isn't worth giving up what she wants to be. That's super cheesy of me to say, but I just really like how Willow doesn't lose her character arc and or doesn't really even try to fit in. She just kind of accepts that judgment and then moves on, which is kind of cool. And then we also see Willow not losing any other part of her character arc when she's revealed to be bisexual. That does not become the thing about her.
Right.
She gets other really important, interesting things.
I think it's important also to recognize that she is bisexual.
Absolutely.
And, you know, because she does have a very, like, apparently very loving and fulfilling relationship with a man.
Yeah,
and then totally. She has a very loving and fulfilling relationship with a woman.
Absolutely.
And I think especially, like, even, like, particularly around Buffy fandom, like, people in the LGBTQ community who are also Buffy fans are very, you know, intentional in pointing out that she is bisexual.
Absolutely.
Because bisexual erasure, you know, is definitely a thing that happens.
In the same way that we were talking about how stories with strong females and who are written for females are definitely sneered at and are definitely lesser. There's also still this mindset that bisexuals just need to choose a side.
It's right.
Like, okay, calm
down.
That's
not how it works.
That's not how it goes. Stop.
At least, like, from what I've heard, it's not how it works.
It's not. That's not what it's, no. So I know specifically when these episodes were first aired, the majority of the characters in media who identified as LGBTQ in other major television shows were given storylines which were entirely like, that's the lesbian.
Right.
Let's see what she's doing with other lesbians.
And, like, that's their only personality trait.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, is she smart? We don't know. She is a lesbian.
Does she have a fulfilling life?
Who knows?
Who cares?
She's got a woman, though. Like, it's just exhausting. And it felt incredibly limiting in those spaces. And I think I'm so happy that this was not the case for Willow. And I also love a character like Willow who's just full of earnest smiles and compassion. I think that's something else that gets mocked is just being honest and being like, I'm excited about the world.
Yeah, being excited about things is not cool.
We're not supposed to do it. Sorry. I might try and be less optimistic in my life because people have been like, you need to tone it down.
You need to tone it down, Erin.
I really do.
You're really bringing up the energy of the whole room.
I'm very sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, I just...
Yay, Willow.
I just wrote yay, Willow, because I feel like...
It's a perfect sentiment.
And, you know, especially for something that was in, like, national syndication, where you could just turn on your screen and see someone who might identify as you did, or you know what I mean? Like, it's just... It was really important to a bunch of friends of mine growing up. I just ruined the thing.
Oh, here.
I
Let
ruined
me help you.
The website.
Let me help you. I'll be a friend.
Oh, thank you. And then just the last thing that I kind of taught, well, okay. So there was a really awkward interview where Joss Whedon discusses.
We just watched like an entire like 30-minute special from Entertainment Weekly.
You should watch it.
It was like the 20-year anniversary.
Yeah, it was real good.
With the entire cast was there. It was great.
It was like one of those.
And they're all still so beautiful.
it was a good time. Joss Whedon was not there, which was a little awkward.
He was like separate from all the
rest, which is weird. So in regards to all of the good things that we're saying about his writing of Willow,
and I think good things about his writing in general. He's a really like very like clever and witty dialogue,
totally.
And like he really like he writes characters with emotional depth.
Absolutely.
And who are, you know, well-rounded people. And like we talked about before, he wrote like strong and, you know, believable women, not just like the, you know, strong female character TM, but like, no, like an actual, totally. Like real well-rounded, strong woman who is like a leader of yeah. this group. And he wrote that, but
yeah, totally, totally.
But other things,
but other things also, like how, oh, I also was thinking about this. I didn't write this in my notes, but I also appreciate how not all the women are naked all the time as yeah. they're being strong women. Like, right. they get to wear clothes, which yeah. is...
like, realistic.
Which is nice. Like,
vampire fighting clothes. I mean, sometimes Buffy does wear leather pants and heels while she's fighting vampires, but, you know, sure. she's, like, she's fashionable, and she yeah. also has like superpowers, so I imagine that that kind of counteracts any awkwardness that sure. leather pants and heels would cause.
Sure.
So I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah. She gets to be like all of us, choosing when she wants to be sexy or when, like we're watching right now, when she's just going to be in
she's
a turtleneck.
Like, yeah, she's got like a turtleneck and braids.
She's given...
I don't remember this episode. Do you?
No.
That's Amy though, right?
Yeah.
She was like a mouse for a while.
Oh.
Remember? Because Amy's a witch, and she, like, somehow, like, by mistake, she was turned into a mouse, and so she was, like, living in Buffy and Willow's dorm room.
Which and mouse was she?
I don't know.
Oh.
But she's back now. She's human again.
Human again.
Oh, yes! The Princess and the Frog.
So my last little blurby yay. That I wrote was just...
Unimpressed, sir.
Yeah, about in regards to some Joss Whedon stuff. But going back to his good parts, so the dialogue in Buffy always strikes me as wonderfully bizarre. So everything is heightened. Every joke is perfectly worded and just such a brilliant zinger. Every moment of villainous foreshadowing is like slow. And I'm going to be the villain who's doing the thing. It's such a contrast between...
Let me tell you my let me do evil the plan.
Thing. And then you have Buffy over here who's like telling some little silly joke. So I think this dialogue really reminded me of Shakespearean dialogue choices. So William Shakespeare would often...
How do we always end up talking about Shakespeare?
Because you asked me to do this podcast with you.
I'm not complaining.
I'm always going to bring it back there.
He's like my literary BFF. So.
It's true. His hair alone was just delightful. I just threw shade at Shakespeare. Sorry, Shakespeare. So William Shakespeare would often have different social or economic classes rhyme or not rhyme, depending on what he was trying to say about elitism or other social hierarchy.
Is it like more fancy to rhyme?
Sometimes.
Like the rich people rhyme.
Yeah, sometimes. So there are plays when he's utilizing that iambic pentameter for all of the elite characters and then ditching that style of writing entirely as soon as he gets to the common folk. I think of this because the differences in the text of Buffy are seen in the good characters versus the evil characters,
yeah,
like we were talking
sure.
about. Yeah, so like I said, the good characters are quick and funny and light, and then the villains... are slow and very kind of sensual and dark and witty. And Buffy and the gang, yeah, just seem to understand each other very quickly. So you don't...
It's reminiscent of Gilmore Girls yeah. dialogue, how that very rapid fire, quick wit...
Absolutely. Yeah,
very Amy Sherman Palladino.
Ugh, love her. Come on the show.
Yeah.
And then we also, so,
yes.
I'm just disclaimer, no one on this show likes Romeo and Juliet very much, but
it's terrible.
As Romeo and Juliet meet in Romeo and Juliet, Their dialogue together forms a perfect sonnet, and that's how you know that they're gonna be in love for a little bit.
And then die. Because they're stupid teenagers.
Because they've been teenagers for 2 years.
They're in middle school.
It's an issue. So we also see this, though, between Buffy and Angel. So when they first meet, they're perfect strangers, but they're completing each other's sentences.
Have we even talked about, are you Team Angel?
I love David Boreanaz.
Okay.
He has aged like a fine wine. Which team are you on?
Oh, well, I'm Team Buffy.
Perfect. Perfect, perfect.
But if I have to choose one of them, then yeah, Angel.
Angel.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad that we feel the same way about this. That's how we know that we're meant to host a podcast together.
Do the test right now. Stop listening to this. Find your podcast co-host. So
we're both also Team Jess. Is that interesting? Ugh. It's because this is like actually a thing though. So you know like the manic pixie dream girl trope. So yes. There's like an opposite thing that's like for guys.
Oh.
And it's like the opposite. It's like the depressive goth slash emo boy that like and Jess from Gilmore Girls totally fits it.
Like all of my pop culture crushes.
Yes, exactly.
Oh gosh.
Kylo Ren fits in that perfectly.
Man.
But it's like this like dark, mysterious, like wounded boy that a girl thinks she can fix.
Do you ever have a moment where you realize you're a cliche and have been so your whole life? This is that moment for me. I'm a cliche, you guys.
And maybe saying it sounds cliche is cliche. Maybe I'm being cliche.
I'm down.
But I am what I am. That's Popeye.
We're all Pam Beasley.
How many times have we quoted The Office this time?
Too few. Could always use more, right, listeners? You're gonna re-listen to this one.
Should we do a dramatic reading?
Heck yes.
Okay. This is perfect. Okay. Oh, we didn't even talk about who's gonna be who.
Oh no. Who would you rather be?
I don't care.
You did the hard work to find this scene.
And then copy and paste.
Hey.
Dramatic reading.
Woo! Would you rather be Buffy or Angel?
I'll be Buffy.
All right.
Okay. So, to set the scene, she's sitting in a graveyard, okay? Mm. And she's talking to herself. Okay. Come on, Stefan, rise and shine. Some of us have a ton of trig homework waiting.
Hey.
Ack!
Is this a bad time?
Are you crazy? You don't just sneak up on people in a graveyard. You make noise when you walk. You stomp or yodel.
I heard you were on the hunt.
I like that voice here, too.
Thank you.
You sound like Batman.
Thank you.
Supposed to be, but Lazy Bones here doesn't want to come out and play.
When you first wake up, it's a little disorienting. He'll show.
It's weird to think of you going through that.
It's weird to go through. You're here alone?
Yeah, why?
I just thought you'd have somebody with you. Xander or someone.
Xander?
Or someone.
No, Xander. Why? Are you jealous?
Of Xander? Please. He's just a kid.
Is it because I danced with him?
Danced with is a pretty loose term. Mated with might be a little closer.
Oh, you're shocking. One little dance and you know I just did it to make you crazy, which, by the way, behold my success.
I'm not jealous. Neither of them notice as they argue that...
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Okay, so this vampire starts crawling out of the grave, looking at them with ravenous glee. Oh, you're not jealous? What? Vampires don't get jealous.
See, whenever we fight, you always bring up the vampire thing.
I didn't come here to fight.
Stefan leaps on her, knocking her to the ground. She throws him off.
Oh, right. I did. Where's my steak? Does she want to go to Outback Steakhouse? Is that... Oh, different kind of steak. Okay.
Oh, okay. Had to check that in the notes.
I don't... Why did we choose that scene? I don't even know.
Because I wanted to talk like this.
You sound like Devin Banks from 30 Rock.
Tina Fey, call me. Hire me next time.
Oh, Tina Fey, please. Okay. Oh, I added this because I just, the episode Restless in, the last episode of season four. So this is the one with like all the different dream sequences.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
I was just watching it the other day and I just started like noting down all the different literary and cultural references in it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if we're in the right mood to talk about this right now. Because this went really silly. but it's good, so we'll talk about it. So the first one is Death of a Salesman. So in Willow's dream, she's in her dream, she is like in this school play. They're back at high school. Yeah. And she's in a school play that she hasn't rehearsed for. So like everybody's backstage in their costumes and everything. Yeah. And Giles is the director and he comes in and he's like, this is going to be the best production of Death of a Salesman we've ever had.
Uh-huh. And
she's like, oh no. So everything in this episode, well, I think throughout the series, but especially in this episode, everything is on purpose.
Yeah.
So I like looked into all of these because I'm a nerd.
I love it.
So Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller.
Yeah.
This is a play, obviously. It uses flashbacks to present the protagonist Willie's memories.
Yeah.
Like interposed with reality.
Yeah.
So there's this illusion not only that it not only suggests that this is in the past, but it also presents this as like, this is like his idealized life.
Yeah.
So it's memory, but it's also fantasy in a way.
Sure.
'Cause he's dreamed of success his whole life.
Yeah.
And he makes up lies about his own success.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of indulges in this illusion, and that makes it harder and harder for him to face the reality that he's in.
Yeah.
So really, you know, the kind of the whole family is living in these lies.
Sure.
And then the next reference is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Huh.
So for this one, it's still Willow's dream, and she's standing up in front of the class, and everyone's, like, laughing at her like they did in high school. And she is holding her paper, and she's like, from my book report, I did The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There are many themes in this book. So The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, of course, is a fantasy. But it also has kind of an exploration of reality versus fantasy because when Lucy comes back the first time she goes into the wardrobe, she comes back and tells her siblings.
Yeah.
And they don't believe her, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's kind of this whole section of the book that that you kind of forget about until you read it again, but there's this whole section where Lucy is kind of like questioning,
yeah,
did that really happen? Did I really go to this magical land? Because like, I know it sounds weird.
Yeah.
But she knows that she has, but sure, there's also this kind of like questioning that like her siblings don't believe her, obviously.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of exploration in that book as well. And then the next one is Apocalypse Now. And this is in Xander's dream. So this is the classic Vietnam War movie written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And it's considered, I think, more widely considered to be an anti-war movie.
Mm-hmm.
But according to Coppola, it is even more what he says, anti-lie.
Yeah.
So this is a quote from him. The fact that a culture can lie about what's really going on in warfare, that people are being brutalized, tortured, maimed, and killed, and somehow present this as moral is what horrifies me and perpetuates the possibility of war.
Yeah.
so this is like, this like happens throughout the series of Buffy.
Yeah.
This kind of, and this is kind of a quest, like a moral question that, that Buffy herself kind of grapples with is like, I'm supposed to be the good guy. I'm supposed to be the hero. And yet, you know, I am the one who is like killing all these,
sure,
like doing all this killing and all this fighting. And then, so this one was weird. So in Giles's dream, he mentions something about, a fable about, a fox and patience. They don't say what the title of it is. So I had to kind of like dig for this a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think that it's talking about, there's several different versions of a fable about a fox and another animal, most often a cat. But the fox boasts to the other animal that he's so clever that he can think of 100 ways to escape his enemies. The other animal says that they only have one way, but they can do it well.
Yeah.
So then a pack of dogs or wolves comes and the other animal uses their one way to escape right away. So when it's a cat, they like climb up into a tree.
Yeah.
There's another version where it's a hedgehog and they like burrow into the ground and hide in a hole in the ground. But the fox is too busy thinking of all the different ways that he could escape. And while he's busy thinking about it, he's attacked by the wolves.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. And this is really interesting. So like throughout all of these dreams, they're all being followed by, the first slayer. Cause in the episode before they had to like call on the spirit of the first slayer so that Buffy would be strong enough to defeat like the big bad of that season.
Okay.
Yeah. So, because they've called on her, like they've like awakened, you know, this ancient power of the first slayer. So she has been kind of like interweaving like through all of their dreams.
Yeah.
So all of the works that are referenced in the dreams deal with the nature of reality and perception.
Yeah.
And they're all, like in relation to the first slayer, who's this figure that's shrouded in mystery and legend.
Cool.
I feel like we need to talk more about the first slayer because she's like super cool.
Yeah.
Super interesting. So the first slayer tells Buffy in her dream that the slayer must be alone, must have no friends and no family. But Buffy soundly rebukes this notion.
Sure.
And actually, again and again throughout the series, Buffy chooses to surround herself with her chosen family that helps her fulfill her mission.
Yeah.
And they all become stronger together because of this, rather than trying to be like a lone wolf, which is why so many slayers before her have failed.
Sure.
And they explore that, too. The most important theme throughout the series is that of one's chosen family. The idea that our strength comes from within, but we're made stronger in community with others.
Yeah.
This is beautifully shown in the finale of the series. This idea of the Slayer defying that kind of lone wolf status is brought to a logical and literal conclusion when the power of the first slayer is unleashed so that every potential slayer in the world is able to join together. So as Buffy says in her St. Crispin's Day speech, everyone who could be a slayer will be a slayer. And so everybody gets to be powerful and we all get to be slayers.
I love that.
I imagine that I would maybe have been a slayer.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know. You're Rhonda the Immortal Waitress. Duh.
I would not last one day as a slayer.
I wouldn't last one day as a waitress. Those people work so hard. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So we can all be slayers, everyone. Erin the Vampire Slayer.
We have Buffy on.
And I wasn't even...
I looked what up happened? After listening to that wonderful lesson from Rhonda, and Doyle from Gilmore Girls
was on the episode.
I forgot that he was like a series regular for like a season, wasn't he?
Mind blown. Yeah. I must have not seen that. Yeah. Wow. Well, anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so since Buffy is like a slightly older work, I think something that we are trying to do with like things that we talk about that have been around for a little while, we also want to talk about the, not just like influences, you know, before them, mm-hmm. but like the influence that this work has had on pop culture since then. We did that a little bit with Star Wars, but I think we didn't, we really need to do another Star Wars episode.
It's true. It's true.
Because we kind of just winged that.
Yeah.
but in thinking about, the legacy that Buffy has had, like its lasting influence on pop culture, I thought of a few different categories of things that show that influence. So we have like the more obvious kind of female-led vampire/supernatural drama romance. So like True Blood, which is based on a series of books.
Sucker! Sucker!
How many vampires am I supposed to care about now? of course, I have Twilight. Wait, I love your face right now.
Kristen, whatever her name is not my favorite person.
Oh,
well, she is now. She wasn't. Yeah. Twilight.
Twilight,
but now,
is not your favorite.
Yeah. Now,
but you know, I think
I love her actually.
I think, okay, don't yell at me, but I think that Twilight suffers from that perception that we talked about earlier about works created for teenage girls being considered less than.
Sure.
Because, you know, like, taking away that whole perception, like, Twilight isn't the greatest, but it's not that bad. Like,
honestly,
I rewatched, like, the first two movies, I think, because they're on Hulu.
Yeah.
Just been, like, Hulu-ing it up lately. And I was like, you know, the first movie, I was like, I like this.
Yeah.
And the second one had issues.
Sure.
But, you know, I think that, like, it was, like, really cool for a while to hate on Twilight.
It really was. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's so hard when you're a teenager who's becoming a star in something. I judged Kristen Stewart hardcore. And then she's a great actress
who's amazing.
Done some really wonderful work. So for my 16-year-old self, I apologize, Kristen Stewart. You're amazing.
I'm sure you're listening.
Everything that I do in my life is watched by Kristen Stewart. She's my one
she's
fan.
She's your biggest fan.
I have one fan, like in Flight of the Conchords. She's my one fan.
Bra.
Anyway.
Which is Kristen Wiig.
Hey.
Yeah. Oh, and then what I really noticed when I watched the TV series of A Discovery of Witches.
So
like when I read the books, I wasn't thinking of it so much, but when I watched the show, I was like, oh yeah, this is totally influenced by Buffy. It's like they spend a lot of time like in a library with like magical books, and there's like, you know, then there's vampires, and there's like a, you know, like witches and stuff. Like, oh yeah, this is totally. And then Chilling Adventures of Sabrina is
also,
I think, filling that niche right now in our culture. Yeah. So those are, and like, I love all of those things too. Like, well, I didn't ever really watch True Blood. I read the books and really liked them. Well, I stopped at like book 6.
That's a lot of books.
That is a lot. Yeah.
That's a lot of
but
books.
But I think it's kind of, like when book series get really long like that.
Yeah.
So I think there are like 10 books. Like when there's that many, they start to go down in quality.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, and then another category we have is, I didn't know what to call this, but girls kicking butt/female superheroes.
Yeah.
Does anyone remember the show Dark Angel starring Jessica Alba?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that, like, it wasn't, I think it was maybe like early 2000s. It was on like at the same time as Buffy.
There was a lot of pleather in the costumes.
Yeah, yes. So and red definitely lipstick.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there was some definite Buffy influence in there. Veronica Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Which several Buffy actors had cameos. Allison Hannigan.
Yeah.
Charisma Carpenter.
Oh, my gosh.
There are at least a couple others, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Joss Whedon had a cameo on Veronica Mars.
Oh my goodness. I had not realized that.
Yeah.
Wow.
He plays a like car rental guy.
Okay.
And, like,
okay.
Yeah.
That's casting I can stand behind. That's right on.
And Veronica has this whole thing where she's like trying to convince him to rent her a car, but she's not 25, so she can't. And she's like, oh no, that's not it. That's not what happens. I don't remember what happens, but she makes up this story about wanting to go see the band Stained.
Oh.
I don't remember exactly, but that's in there.
You mean Stained, spelled
Stained.
S-T-A-N-D.
There's an apostrophe, I think.
And they left out the E.
Stained.
Oh, dear.
We have other Joss Whedon shows. Firefly.
Uh-huh.
Has River Tam.
Uh-huh.
Who is a teenage girl superhero as well. And Dollhouse, which starred Eliza Dushku.
Ugh, Eliza Dushku.
She's so great. She's so cool.
Also, the cool rebel in Bring It On.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I always forget that she's in that.
Your school has no gymnastics team. This is a last resort. Loved her.
And then Joss Whedon also wrote and directed, or at least, like, was like a co-writer. I don't know if he actually like wrote it by himself or
sure.
co-writer for the Avengers, the first Avengers movie in 2012.
Yeah.
And I think he had something to do with the Justice League movie
mm-hmm,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see it though because it wasn't Wonder Woman. So,
uh-huh.
I mean,
yeah.
Understandable.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like clearly he has a lot of things to say about superheroes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
And I was watching, so Avengers Endgame is coming out like a week and a half or something.
Yeah.
And I was watching, it was like a like round table discussion with the cast. And it was actually, the interviewer was actually did a really good job because there's like eight people that he was trying to interview.
Sure.
But he asked Scarlett Johansson, he asked her a question about, you know, kind of like the kind of like, I guess, resurgence or like the kind of renaissance of female superheroes that we're hopefully starting to have now.
Yeah.
With Wonder Woman, Captain
yeah.
Marvel. And he asked her like what influence she thought Black Widow had on
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah.
Which Black Widow still doesn't have her own movie.
Sure.
Fix that.
Fix it. Right now. Right
but
now.
She made a really good point that, you know, Joss Whedon was the one, you know, it was in the Avengers movie that we really started to see Black Widow as more than just, like, girl who beats people up. Like, we started
uh-huh.
to see her as an actual character in that first Avengers movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the one that Joss Whedon was involved with. And then she, Scarlett Johansson also kind of alluded to, she probably was not contractually allowed to say the title Buffy the Vampire Slayer just because of, like, contracts and things.
Sure.
But she kind of alluded to it, and she was like, and, you know, Joss Whedon has, you know, in his history that's been something that he's really written a lot about. So
yeah.
So I don't know. I just have feelings. Oh, and then we just watched the musical episode of Buffy. And we were talking about how a lot of TV series ended up doing musical episodes.
Yeah.
After that. And then there are entire series that,
sure.
like, the whole series is a musical.
Yeah.
which is no.
And they're like
interesting,
well made, and
yeah
do pretty well, I think.
Yeah,
well, Smash didn't because it was canceled.
Yeah, it has a huge cult following.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah, that's true.
Us musical theater performers are like, more of this for the next 10 years.
Yes, please.
Please.
Yes, please. Yes, and then Crazy Ex-Girlfriend that we love.
That I did not want to love.
Because of the title.
Because of the title. Yeah. I judged a book by its title and it steered me wrong. It's a wonderful show. Watch it right now.
Hmm. And then just, I wasn't sure how to work this in, but just to mention, there's a novel that just came out.
Oh,
cool. It's called Slayer, uh-huh. And it's actually in the same, like, it's in the universe of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Cool.
But it's like now times. And
the now times.
And it's about this teenage girl who discovers that she's the last Slayer. So I don't know what exactly happened in between the end of the series and now that she's now the last Slayer.
Interesting.
I don't know. But it's by Kirsten White, and we'll put a link to it in on our blog.
You should buy it.
You should buy it.
Then we can still be associates with Amazon. They'll still let us play with them. On the playground.
Support the show.
Woo-hoo!
Woo! Which Buffy character are you, Erin?
I am Giles all the way. Although, you know, I really think I'm more of a Tara, but...
Okay.
But...
You don't think you're a Xander?
Oh, I could only aspire to be Xander. What about you?
Well, according to the quiz, I'm Willow.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah. She's a good character.
I feel like Willow was a medieval gentlewoman.
It's true.
Just as I was.
I'm relieved that neither of us were Spike.
Would anyone really... Like, I don't feel like that's a realistic personality.
I remember dating in my early 20s. I feel like those characters are out there.
Interesting.
Okay, Cupid thought that those were who I should date in my 20s, early 20s. Anyway.
And not a person who you matched with 97% or whatever it was.
That never happened.
You guys, when Erin and I were both single, like years and years ago.
Years and years, wow,
we were both on OkCupid.
Yeah.
And we found each other on there, and we were a 97% match.
Best friend goals right there. Best friend goals.
And then we started a podcast together. Well, look, we've been talking for like an hour and a half.
And you're still listening.
We can talk for another hour and a half what's going on now? We both looked up at the same time, and there's something. Okay.
You guys, If you ever have a really long task, maybe like an hour or more.
Put on season 6 of Buffy. I think it has to be season 6 because that's when all the magic happens.
Ha. And then feel free to forget it's on and then look back up and you'll get a funny joke.
Yeah. These are the jokes. They don't get any better. All right, well, once again, we have no idea how to end this.
No.
We're like an SNL sketch.
We don't know. We need Lorne Michaels.
No, we need not Lorne Michaels.
That is more accurate. Although, Lorne, I am accepting casting decisions if you're...
Yeah, if you need two people to play podcasters.
Play podcasters.
Okay, so
thank you, Erin,
maybe we should be like a Beach Boys song and just like fade it out.
So just keep talking and then
just keep talking and just like gradually fade it. Or I could do the impression of my dad standing up from the couch.
That is an excellent way to end, I think.
Okay. Okay, I don't know if you're gonna be able to hear it. Let's just end it like Weekend Update.
I'm Michael Che, and you're Colin Jost.
I'm Colin Jost. Good night, and have a pleasant tomorrow. Right? Isn't that... Oh, that was Tina Fey who said that. I don't know.
Bye. Oh, gosh, I pressed... What?
suppress